Welcome to the fourth week of the Tapestry of God, Spring 2007 edition. The four golden threads and the one red line. This is the old title of chapter 4. I didn't get around to changing it for my presentation last year. Is that God delivered his people Israel and gave them his written law. This year you see that the new title is God's Law Highlights the Four Golden Strands and One Red Line, because as I went through this lesson and just edited a few things here and there and was considering original sin, justification, that God fixed sin, the effective means of grace, that God communicated his solution to mankind, and the cross, bearing the cross, a life of suffering in this world. Welcome, come on in. Have a seat. Hi, Lauren.
Hey,
I realize that really this lesson, again, I mean, it just fits so perfectly into thinking it in the terms of the four and the one, the four golden strands and the one red line. So tonight, again, we get to see so many of the themes that have already been started are now continuing on until the time of Christ. Genesis leads us with the story of Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, who is also called Israel. Joseph ends up as the second in command of all of Egypt. His fathers and his brother come down to Egypt to live with him. Some of the wisdom in God in this is that Canaan was not a good place religiously to be. Peoples live very close to each other, and the false religion of the Canaanites we'll talk about a little later, but it was very alluring to the Israelites, and so they're kind of getting mixed in with the wrong crowd, so to speak. God takes them to a land by having Joseph bring them down to Egypt, where the Egyptians want nothing to do with them. The Egyptians are snobs. They're very highly intellectual. They're a very sophisticated society, and a bunch of sheep herders from Canaan are not people they want to associate with. They're kind of hillbillies and not really up to snuff. And so they give them their own part of the land that nobody else wants, the part of the land for shepherds. And they say, yeah, you guys just go live there. And it keeps them separate. It keeps them away from people. It's actually a really good plan that God puts into the start here. But the book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible, starts 300 years after the death of Joseph. The Israelites, who we will refer to as the descendants of Jacob, I guess we could call them Jacobites too, are being oppressed and enslaved by the Egyptians. Not good news. And Exodus is the story of God's deliverance of his people from slavery to Egypt. But there's more to Exodus than the physical deliverance. Tonight we're going to especially focus on the spiritual deliverance that God gave his chosen people, Israel. When you talk to Jewish scholars and Christian scholars alike, and if you watch a program on PBS or the History Channel about the Exodus, we're going to be talking about political views and how religion and politics went together. Hi, Giovanni. Come on in. And you get all caught up in the political story of it, of a freedom story, and especially in America, we like a freedom story. People going from slaves to free, yeah, that's what we're all about here in America, especially after 1865. So to get just caught on the physical Exodus is missing a lot of the point. So tonight we look at the spiritual things behind it. Moses is the leader of the Israelites coming out. We're going to talk about him, but first I thought I'd give you the Moses timeline. You have it there on your sheets. From 0 to 40. Moses is a prince of Egypt. There's a law that says that every time a baby is born, the Hebrew midwives, the nurses, so to speak, who delivered the babies, were supposed to check. If it's a male, kill it. If it's a female, let it live. The midwives, when it came to Moses, saw that it was a boy and let him live. And then Moses' mother put him in a basket and set him in the reeds on the side of the river, where Pharaoh's daughter finds him. So he grows up in Pharaoh's household, and she adopts him as his own. Moshe means to draw from the river. So he's brought in from the river, so Moses becomes his name. It always reminds you of his origin. And for 40 years, he lives like that, as the prince of Egypt. Then from 40 to 80, he's a shepherd in Midian. He leaves Egypt and goes Midian because, anybody know the reason why? At age 40, he all of a sudden leaves his fancy life in Egypt to live in a desert that looks like Utah or Nevada? Because he killed a man. An Egyptian was beating up on a Hebrew slave, and Moses knew he was Hebrew. So he did a little killing and tried to cover it up. But somebody found him out, he got freaked out, and he ran. And he ran to a place where nobody would find him, out to Midian. And he's there for 40 years. If you think of Moses leading the Israelites out, you probably think of Charlton Heston, if you grew up in the 60s or 70s. And, you know, the big long white beard. And yeah, he's 80 years old. He's probably getting up there in years. We see he lives another 40 years after that, and his life really is split 40-40-40. And the last 40 years of his life, he's the leader of Israel. So only a third of his life is he a leader of Israel. Kind of an interesting journey for Moses. I would have liked to have seen what happened between 0 and 40 and 40 and 80. We only hear that one instance in between 0 and 80. After he's brought up out of the river, we just hear about the murder, and he runs away. That's it. And then he's a shepherd. God chose Moses to lead his people. When it comes to accomplishing his plan of salvation, it's always God who does the choosing. We saw that last week. Abram didn't do anything. There's nothing special about Abram. He didn't smell particularly good. He wasn't a particularly great guy. God just said, "You're the one. Through you, all nations will be blessed." Jacob, a deceiver, a heel grabber who tripped up his brother and stole the inheritance from him. And God still says, "Through you, I choose you. You will be the son who bears the Savior." For no particularly good reason, God chooses these people. And it's the same thing with Moses. He chooses Abraham and his descendants, Isaac and Jacob. And he also chooses Moses, who is a murdering coward. Somebody who wouldn't even fess up to his crime or do the time for it, who instead just leaves and runs away and tries to cover it up. Not who I would choose to lead the Israelites. I would take somebody who was a very devout Israelite, who was a good, upstanding citizen, who was living in Egypt, who was a slave. But he takes somebody who came from the ruling class, who grew up Egyptian, and then ran away and lived in the desert for 40 years. He chooses him. Why? I don't know, because he chose him. That's why. So, God chooses Moses to lead his people tonight. You don't necessarily need to open your Bibles. If you'd like to, feel more than welcome to, but there's your text. You can read along up there on the left. Now, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. Jethro's other name is Reuel, R-U-E-L, so if you ever run across that name, it's the same guy. He's not a flute playing rock person. That's somebody else entirely. This guy's a Midianite. The priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, "I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up." When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." Then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. In that section, you'll see that God identifies himself as Moses, or identifies himself to Moses as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When God does this, Moses hides his face. What reason is given for this action?
He sinned.
Okay, that's the root cause of it, but what does the text say? Why he hid his face because of what?
He was afraid.
He was afraid. Why is the human reaction to being in the presence of a holy God always hiding, Desiree? Why is the reaction always being afraid when you're in the presence of God? You've said it before?
Because he sinned.
Yeah. Realized he was a sinful human being. Maybe that's why God chose him. Moses could never pull off a statement thinking that he could stand in the presence of God, because when you do something horribly wrong, it always sticks in your head. People might forgive you for it. You might get over it and not always think about it, but it sticks in there, and you know it. And all of us too tonight. The reaction of a human being to being in the presence of the holy God is fear. The other night we had our windows open, as we do pretty much every night, breeze coming through. And I think they might have been working on one of the streets around our area or something, but there was the sound of distant rumbling and a continuous distant rumbling, and it woke both of us up, and it was just kind of that eerie feeling of you don't quite know what's going on, it's the middle of the night. And my wife actually said, "You hear that?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "This isn't Judgment Day, is it?" And I said, "No, I would think it'd be louder than that." She said, "Okay." But it freaked her out. She said the next day she couldn't shake it. She felt icky and afraid. A Christian her whole life and afraid of the final day because you know it. We know it in our head, and it's one thing to know it in your head. But then to have to experience being in the presence of the holy God, there's a part of you that wants to dive and run under the tables, and Moses is no different. There's nothing that he's doing to make Moses afraid. He calls out to him by name. Again, God goes after sinners and calls to them. And yet, he's afraid. We go to Exodus 3, 7 through 10, which is our next section. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Notice he's sending them back to the land of the Canaanites where they came from. With Abram, he promised Abram when he made that promise, "Through you all nations will be blessed." He also made a promise that "I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying." He always said that to every single person that he'd pass that promise along with the code words of "all nations will be blessed through you." The blessing of the promised Savior is always connected into the Holy Land. So the Israelites were never meant to stay in Egypt forever. This was only a temporary situation, and now God sees this is no longer a good situation for my people, so I'll put them back where they were supposed to be in the first place. Let's read that next section. 11 through 15. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." Another word for Horeb is Sinai. So when they come back to the Mount of Sinai, they're back where Moses started. Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites: I am has sent me to you." God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation.'" Since this section deals primarily with God's name, that's what we should talk about. What name does God give himself here?
I am.
Lauren? I am. That's what he says. I am is a perfect description of God. There's no time when he was not in existence. In the beginning was God. And before the beginning was God. And God has no beginning. And that'll cramp your brain if you think about it too much. He currently is. When God says "I am" to Moses, he exists. When God says "I am" to you and to me, he's still here. He has not changed. He is who he was and is who he is. And he'll always be in existence. There's no time in the future where God will not be. That is a lot of permanence. to always have been, to always be, and to always will be in the future. And how does that fact, revealed in this name of God, increase our trust in Him? Maybe a deep question, but let's see how you do.
Well, is it kind of like, if He says that He was always in control of everything and will always be there, that you have to trust the fact that He did and He will. So
when He says something,
it's true.
It's true. He of anyone should know. That's one aspect of it. I want to trust somebody who's been around a long time. How many companies advertise that way? Since 1850, serving you. We know what we're doing, basically. We've been doing it for this long. Trust us. We know what we're doing. 1850 is fairly recent compared to God. Let me ask a leading question to see if you can see the other side of the coin. What's the biggest problem with everybody that you know right now? And everybody that you love right now? Every single person you know has a flaw that if it kicks in before your flaw kicks in, it's going to be a miserable time. Anybody remember that list of people from Adam to Noah? You remember what phrase was repeated over and over again in that list?
And they died.
And then they died. I trust my parents, and then they die. Your kids trust you. And then there's a day when they can't turn to you anymore because you're not there. And you can't have trust because there's no one there to have trust with. And they could have made you all sorts of promises. Sweetie, I'll be at your wedding. I'll always be there for you. And their wedding day comes and you died of a heart attack 10 years before. You made a promise and you couldn't keep it, and it's not your fault. It's just the way it is. With any promise that a human being makes, there's always the risk that it won't happen just because it can't, because of death. So that's why you buy life insurance. Because at least if I'm not going to be there, there will be money there, and you can remember with your money and have a good time. But the fact that God is always there, He never leaves. Everything in this world changes, and the more you're in this world, the more you realize that it's probably the worst thing about this world. There's a changeability of everything. Nothing ever stays the same. There's no stability. God's the only stable thing. So the fact that He is and will always be is very comforting to me. When you see the Lord, or I am in all caps, I used to think when I was a kid, like in verse 15, I would read it this way when I was a kid. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord! Like I was shouting, you know, big capital letters. It's written in all capital letters because it's the Hebrew Yod, He, Vav, He are those four Hebrew letters. You read from right to left in Hebrew, so that little blip is a Yod. If you've heard of the phrase jot and tittle, a Yod is a jot. It's an English way of expressing the Hebrew Y-O-D, Yod. It's a little tiniest little flick of a pen that you can make, and it's a Y sound. H and a W or a V sound and an H. And that's how you get, with those combination of letters, you either get Jehovah or Yahweh, if you've heard those two names. Hebrew people don't say this. They say Hashem, which means the name. They don't say it because the second commandment is, you shall not misuse this name, this very specific name. And they said, what better way not to misuse it than never use it? So they're forbidden to say it. And when they teach us to read Hebrew, they teach us to pronounce this not with Yahweh or Jehovah. You'll never hear me say that reading Hebrew. You'll hear Adonai, which means Lord. But it's not the Lord. And that's why L-O-R-D is in all capital letters there, because it's not the Lord, but I am. So just for your, if you ever wondered why it was capitalized some places, if you see L-O-R-D not capitalized, like the first letter capitalized and the rest all small in the Old Testament, that's Adonai. It's a different word. It's ruler, master, Lord. But when you see it in all capital letters, it's God's name that he gave Moses, I Am. God delivered Israel from Egypt by working mighty wonders through Moses. He sent 10 plagues on the Egyptians. Many of them are against Egyptian gods. They considered the Nile to be a god, so God makes the Nile into blood. They considered fish and frogs to be gods. All the fish die when the water turns to blood because they don't get oxygen. Frogs come up out of the river and swarm the land, and they would think, oh, our frog god is displeased with us. All of these different things, gnats and flies, pretty much top 10 of horrible, disgusting things. Pharaoh allows God's people to leave from the promised land after 10 of them. The promised land is called the promised land because it was promised to Abraham, by the way. That's why we refer to it as the promised land. The last plague was by far the worst, and it's this plague that we're going to examine closely. I would try to name off all 10, but I think I would probably mess it up. So if you'd like to see all 10, you can review them by watching Prince of Egypt, if you'd like to see a video of it. Or you can look in your Bibles in Exodus and get the full list of them. Okay, here's the Passover. It's in Exodus 12. Both 3 through 11. This is God speaking to Moses, giving him instructions on what to do. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the people of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and the tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire along with bitter herbs, and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or cooked in water, but roast it over the fire, head, legs, and inner parts. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. This section we're going to come back to again and again because it's a big deal. We'll see why as we continue on. Exodus 12, 12 through 13 continues on. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. Notice capital L-O-R-D, I am Jehovah. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see that blood, I will pass over you. Thus the name Passover. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. It's a lot of death. To have the firstborn of every single family and every single animal family die, that's a whole lot of death going on. The Israelites were saved from the angel of death by the blood of the Lamb. This is not a coincidence. This is very much not a coincidence. This is the first paragraph of a sermon that's going to be preached to the Israelites over and over and over again. You're going to see it in the sacrificial system, but nowhere do you see it as clearly as you see it here. Sin must be paid for by blood. Remember that when God promised Adam and Eve a savior, he said that he would crush Satan's head, but Satan would strike his heel. When Satan strikes a heel, you bleed. When a snake strikes a heel, you bleed. Blood flows. Blood flow is a big deal for Hebrew people. You don't eat anything that has blood flowing from it. You make sure that all the blood is out of it by roasting it. Jewish people barbecue. They don't broil. They don't do fancy-dancy stovetop stuff. They make sure that thing is burned. When you do a sacrifice for a Jewish person, first the blood pours, and then you throw it on the fire. and you burn the whole thing up. For some of their complete burnt offerings, they would do that. And a complete burnt offering is a holocaust, a complete devastation of whatever it is that you're destroying. In the Old Testament, when you see it was dedicated to God, it usually means it died and was burnt up completely. It means all the smoke went up in the air and ascended up to God to an offering for Him. But sin must be paid for by blood. When you go through and you look at all the weird laws that God has for His people, so many of them have to do with animal sacrifice. And again, you look at Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Your blood's son will flow. Oh, wait, you don't want your son's blood to flow? Okay, then a substitute. Here's a ram caught in the thicket. Kill it and sacrifice it and burn it on the altar. Very gory. A lot of blood. More blood than an average American would tolerate. And again, if you were to make a movie out of the Bible, this would not be PG because of the amount of blood.
Do Jewish people still sacrifice to live today?
It's a problem with that. Sacrifice has to be done by priests in the temple. Or on the Passover, a priest in the temple has to approve your animal for sacrifice, but it's a home sacrifice. You do this at home with your family. What's the problem with that today? With the whole Jewish sacrificial system being set up in the temple? There's no temple. It was torn down in 70 AD by the Romans. So they can't. Why do you think Jewish people really want to get back on that Temple Mount where the Muslims are? And they're fighting back and forth. Because they can't have their sacrifices. For modern Jew, sacrifice is whatever. They've moved on. I read a book by a rabbi, a modern American or British rabbi, one of the two. And I wondered what they did about sacrifice and stuff. And it becomes your personal sacrifice, what I sacrifice for God, things I give up in my life. Because you have to make it a metaphor if you can't physically do it anymore. But if you would have gone to the temple, and again we'll talk about this more and more, in the Old Testament, New Testament times, it would have smelled like a combination of barbecue and slaughterhouse because he had so much death going on. And it's very intimate, too, the way they would do it. They would confess their sins on these animals' heads by placing their hand on their head. And then as they were confessing their sins onto this animal and saying what they had done specifically, then the priest stabs it in the jugular. Now, there were two ways of doing it. One was stabbing and the other was slitting. It depends on who you talk to. I think both methods were used. But to have an animal die under your hand because you put your sin on it. Sin has to be paid for by blood. I deserve to die. The wages of sin is death. God said, if you sin, you will die, and I deserve to die, so I don't want to do that. This animal has to take it for me. It's a big deal. And it's, again, it's repeated again and again and again. Any other questions about the animal sacrifice? Passover, we're going to hit it again. We're really going to go into it in big detail because it comes into play during Holy Week. There's a reason that Christians celebrate communion with wine and unleavened bread. You just saw the menu the page before. You see it up there. Bread made without yeast in verse 8. When Adam was created, he was holy. He knew right from wrong perfectly in his heart. But sin is corrosive. Because of sin, the law of God, which is written in our hearts, is no longer perfect. That law of God written in your hearts is your conscience. That's what that voice is. It's a natural knowledge of God that you know certain things are right and certain things are wrong. It's not a coincidence that when you look at the major law codes of the world, everybody agrees murder is not good. Everybody agrees taking other people's stuff is not good. People get the basics of morality, and because of that, that's still God's law written in our hearts, that we do get it to a point. But it's a changeable thing. My favorite, not least favorite story, but favorite example, best example of this, is how Nazis would train their SS guards. I mean, you read the things that these people did to other people, and you're like, how could you ever do that? How could you kill another human being like that? Well, they would give them puppies, German Shepherd puppies. and have him raise them from early on and become very emotionally attached to them. And then they give him a gun and say, dispatch your dog. Put it down. And they would have a horrible time doing it. They could barely do it. And so they'd do it. And the minute they had just done it, they'd give him a new puppy. Have him raise it. And say, put it down. Over and over again until you get desensitized. Eventually, you find something inside that will tell you that you're okay. I think we all experience that. You don't need to be a Nazi to know what that feels like. But to have something that you know, deep down, you know that's not right. But you got justification for it in your head. You've come up with a list of excuses, a list of reasons why I do this. And it makes sense to you. And it sounds good to you. And the more you tell yourself, the more you believe it. And that's what you call killing your conscience. And you practice it and you get good at it. And people who are very practiced and very good at it do some horrible things because there are no limits. If you have a messed up conscience and you want to know what's right and wrong, you need somebody to tell you who doesn't have a messed up conscience. And God is that person, so to speak. God wanted his children to know exactly what he expected, so he gave them the law. Not just Ten Commandments, but there's hundreds of other ceremonial and civil laws. I believe one of your homework assignments is... I didn't give it to you. There are some weird laws. I could have given you some lists and numbers of some laws you didn't know existed. If you borrow your neighbor's rake and you break it while you're breaking out rocks from your yard, you have to give your neighbor a brand new rake and pay him what the rake was worth, too, in cash. Not exactly one of the Ten Commandments that we've all heard, but it was part of their civil law of here's what you do when someone does you wrong. And there are some really, really odd ones. That was mildly odd. But he gave them the Ten Commandments and all these other laws at Mount Sinai, which is the same as Mount Horeb, where Moses was first called in the middle of the desert in Midian, as recorded in Genesis chapter 20. Here we have what it is. This green area up here is the delta. Living in the Sacramento Delta, you know why it's green and everything else is brown, because here's the river that flows, the Nile River flows out into the Mediterranean. So that's the land of Goshen where the Israelites stay. Nice fertile land with plenty of green grass for their sheep to eat. Most of the Egyptians wanted to be along the river, but not actually in like a fertile basin area that would flood a lot. They wanted to stay up in this area. When the Israelites leave, they cross either here, depending on where you want to say they cross. They come back down, and Sinai is probably here. I saw a news special that said it's over here. Either or, I think this one's actually okay to be the traditional site of Sinai. So they come down in this area, that's what it looks like. I believe that this is actually supposed to be the top of Mount Sinai. The traditional site of Mount Sinai. Again, looks a lot like Nevada or Utah. A lot of rocky, craggy, not hospitable land to go through. And there's your picture of Moses. You have a hard time imagining what he looks like. God summarized his commands best in Leviticus. We're going to be talking about the Ten Commandments in a later lesson, so if you want to review them, they're in Exodus 20. But if you want to sum them all up, it's be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. So, nothing short of perfection. This is what I expect. Perfection. That's not good. Agree or disagree, the Old Testament people were saved by obeying the Ten Commandments. The New Testament people were saved by Jesus.
No, disagree.
Why do you disagree?
Because then they have to sacrifice.
Ah.
The Old Testament.
When you read the commands and you go through not just the Ten Commandments, but all the other commandments, after they list what you have to do for restitution, they give you the sacrifice that you have to do. When you goof up, you gotta pay with blood. Yours or a sacrifice. It's your choice. Some of them it was yours. If you owned a bull who you knew was capable of goring someone and the fence was broken and you didn't mend it and you left it unrepaired and the bull went out and gored somebody, the bull would be put to death and then you would be put to death. Sacrifice or no sacrifice, you're forgiven, your sin is removed from you, and now you have to die because your carelessness cost the life of another human being. Wow. But in all these cases, sin was paid for by blood. Did that blood actually save them? Did God go, oh good, you killed a bull, or you killed a goat, or you killed a lamb. We're square. So why do it? Were they just gory people who like to kill things?
Sounds like they were punished.
The animals are punished?
Well, whoever was killing them.
The priest got off. They didn't get punished from killing the animals because that was their job. The way to look at this is if you look at the Old Testament here and the New Testament here. In the Old Testament, you have all this animal sacrifice. So let's draw the bull. Put a ring in his nose. Let's sacrifice a bull. His blood flows out. But it doesn't save anyone. All it does is teach them the lesson. It's an illustration. It's a very vivid illustration. You sin, blood flows. You sin, blood flows. Pointing them ahead to, you sinned, his blood will flow. So here you have Christ on the cross, and his blood is flowing for everyone. Old Testament, New Testament, across all time. Then all the sacrifices had reached their completion. In the confession of sin, I said how we worship. We all confess our sin up front, but you never see me make Linda, for example, since you're a member. Linda, place your hand on this goat. Tell us what you've done this week. Now, there goes the goat. Have a seat. Next. You know, let's put it up on the altar and start a fire. We don't have a chimney coming out of St. Mark's. Why not? Because it's all paid for. It's already done. But this is just the practice lesson. This is the illustration, and what a potent illustration it is. To see that again and again and again. So that's the way of thinking of that question. They're all saved by Christ. It's just that they had to wait for the fulfillment of the promise. And you'll see that animal sacrifice started as soon as Cain and Abel. Abel brought a blood sacrifice to God. Noah sacrificed animals that he brought on the ark when he came out. A blood sacrifice had been going on, but now God makes it very clear. Here's exactly what I want done. Very accurately. God knew he set the bar too high for sinful people. That's why he gave them the picture of a sacrificial system pointing ahead to Christ, that sin must be paid for by blood. This is very important. This is one of my favorite sections to go through in class. Kind of puts it all there, all together, everything that we've learned so far. Paul wrote to the Romans, as it is written, there is no one righteous. That's another word for perfect, another word for holy. Not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. What person in what story have you heard so far that went after God? What sinful human being chased after God and said, ooh, God, 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 hey, hey, I'm talking to you. Hey, pay attention to me. Hey, I want to give my life to you. None of them did that. They were all hiding, doing their own little sinful thing when God picked up the rock that they were living under and said, hey, you, guess what? You're the one. You're going to have the kid who's going to save the world eventually. One of your kids will. So, promised land is yours. I'll be with you. Any questions? All right. Not once did anyone seek God. He always went after, from Adam and Eve all on down. He was the one who went after people. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There's no reason for God to look at anyone and say, good guy, like that guy. There's no one who does good, not even one. Now we know what whatever the law that's supposed to be says. It says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Parents of teenagers, you know what God feels like when you have told them 11:30, not 11:31, not 11:32, 11:30, you will be home and in this house where there will be consequences. And they come home at 12:05 and they say, "Oh, but my watch stopped and I didn't know the time." And I said 11:30. Did I not make it clear? Yes. What time is it? 12:05. Do you understand? Yes. Just don't give me the excuses.
You're grounded, apparently.
And here's your consequence. You're grounded, right? God gives us the law so that we don't go, "But you didn't tell us." Oh. Yes, I did. Yes, I did tell you what you were supposed to do. And you didn't do it. So don't try to come up with, "I was kind of better than the guy down the street." Don't come up with, "I was a pretty good husband or wife, and my children all survived, mainly." No, there's nothing you can do before God to say, I'm good enough to go into heaven. If you watch Inside the Actor Studio, one of the host's favorite questions is there a heaven? And if there were a heaven, what are you going to say to God when you get there? You know, if you've got flippant answers like, "Hey, buddy, nice to see you," or, you know, I did good, God, I did good." No, you didn't. Come on. We've seen the papers. We know what you're up to. You're not a good guy. You play good roles on TV, but you're not a good guy. All the mouths, the whole world held accountable to God. There's no excuses. Therefore, no one. This is like, the third, fourth time we've heard no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. How many people think Christians are good people because they observe the Ten Commandments? We should have the Ten Commandments in all of our schools and all of our public places because that's what good people do. We do the Ten Commandments. That's what we do. No. No one is righteous by observing the Ten Commandments because we all stink. We can't keep them. Even when we try real hard, we break them without thinking because that's what we do by nature. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. The law makes us realize we're not good people. You really can't read the Ten Commandments and go, "Oh yeah, I'm set." No, you're not. So why did God give his law? God's law can only save someone who keeps every last bit of it. I'm not going to say God's law can't save you. It can save you if you do it all. But you've already goofed that one up, so you're not that person. So the law can only do one thing for you. It can show you how badly you failed. Very much like a mirror. There are a lot of things that go wrong with my hair, my face, that I can't see because the problem with my hair and the face is they're on my head. And my eyes are on my head too. And if I didn't have a wife, and if I didn't have a mirror, mainly my wife because I miss things in the mirror, there'd be a lot of times I'd get out of the room and have a lot wrong with me. But it takes her going, "Honey, no, really, the alfalfa thing's going on in the back of your head again. You gotta get rid of that. Or you got something right here. I need people to tell me that. Or, honey, they invent those clippers for a reason. Get to it." She lets me know these things. It's not fun for her, but she's my mirror. Or if I happen to look in the mirror, I see these things, and I can't ignore them. I know that when I walk into a group of 8th graders, they will critically analyze the way I look that day and find something to pick on me about because I'm their teacher. So I might as well not give them any ammunition. That's what the law does for us. You can convince yourself you are a good person. We all do it. I do it a lot in my marriage because that's why I'm right and my wife is wrong. Because I'm always the good guy. Until she lays down what it is exactly that I have done, and then I realize, oh yeah, I guess I did do that. But we're great editors of our own lives, and we make it very, very glowing on our side that, oh yeah, it wasn't all great, but better than most, right? No, God's law says no, not better than most, equal. This, if we stop right here, bad news, people. You're going to go home afraid tonight because if tonight, it's not the pavement equipment that's making the noise, but God's judgment trumpets. You can't actually stand up before him. You got to do the Moses thing and be afraid and fall down. Because sin is paid for by blood and there's no lambs around. So what are you going to do? That's why Paul continues. But now a righteousness from God. Okay, a holiness from God, not from you. This holiness is not self-generated. It's given. It's from outside of you. A righteousness from God apart from the law. That's method number one. Do the law perfectly and you're righteous. Here's method number two for all of us who can't get our act together with method number one. Mm-hmm. Apart from the law has been made known to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. Faith is a simple trust. I simply trust that Jesus is my substitute. And I put my sins on his head, and he paid for them. And I trust that. And in return, God says, yeah, then he covers you. Because he did. I trust what is true. There is no difference for all. Again, look at that word, all. No one, this time all. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace. Grace is undeserved love. God loves us like a mother. There's no reason, but he does because we're his. By his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ, by Christ Jesus. A redemption is a buying back. We did not belong to God, and God bought us back from slavery to sin. Kind of like the slavery the Egyptians were in, or the Israelites were in Egypt. And he brought them out. We were enslaved to our sin. Can a slave do anything? How much free will does a slave have to do his own thing?
Actually, they hardly have any.
Yeah.
Because if you're a slave, you're basically locked up.
Exactly. If you're a slave, you are locked up. You have no freedom to do anything you want to do. You must do what your master says. Is there any better description of us than slave to sin? We just do the sin thing. We're a slave to it. And then Christ comes along and buys us out of that with his blood. Next week, we're going to see the story of our salvation continue as the children of Israel actually move into the promised land. This week, we got them on their way. Talked about the Passover, but we didn't actually get to the promised land yet. They'll show themselves to be sinners unworthy of God's love. Your homework is going to show you that before next week's lesson does. These people, you shake your head at them because they're pretty thick in the head. God does miraculous things for them. And then they have the audacity to say, you're not being nice to us. But God will show them his grace, that he loves them even though they are unworthy. Although they leave him, he does not leave them. So don't read chapter 5 before class. You don't have the books that have chapter 5 in it. And if you did, you probably wouldn't do it anyway. So what you're going to do, though, however, is your homework. And I gave you options. Everybody likes options. You can do one of the two, or if you really want to try to be the best in the class, you can do both of them. Whichever one piques your interest. Exodus 5 through 14 will give you the story of the Exodus. If you want to challenge yourself, you can do both. You can follow all the plagues, and you can see their effect, particularly on Pharaoh. Pharaoh's not, he doesn't give up real easy. He's kind of tenacious. It takes the plague of the angel of death to make him give up. And even then, he chases after them. Exodus 17, Numbers 14, 16, 20, 21 verses 4 through 9, and 25. You see some stubborn sinfulness in God's people here, and even his leaders. You would think Moses and his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam, these three people who are like the leaders of Israel, would get it, that they would know what they're doing. And they even blow it. It's just amazing, the lack of... again, we get really down on them until you look in the mirror and you see yourself and go, oh yeah, well, I guess I'm not that great either. And yet he sticks with them and he's faithful to their promises. And if you're not a parent yet, you'll get it someday. If you are a parent, just look at the Old Testament and know God starts out as God and stays God. He is the eternal parent. And the kids just go from two-year-olds to teenagers. That's all they do. The only difference between my two-year-old and Linda's teenager is the teenager's smarter. They got the same tendencies. They've learned to temper down their tantrums and try to work you. My two-year-old knows how to work us, but she's real basic at it. She gets better. The only difference between the Old Testament people and New Testament people is we've gotten better at covering up our mistakes.
Did she just turn two?
No, not yet, July. But she's acting two, so I'll call her two, because that's what she's doing.
So she's a year right now.
Yeah. So that's it for the fancy pictures. I don't know how this is working for you. For me, it kind of helps me, that it keeps me on track. Otherwise, I like to get off track, and then it turns into 8:30, you know? Do you have any questions? Mm-hmm. That's the one drawback, is I forget to ask questions because I'm just PowerPointing it.
No.
Did the Bible passages work out okay up here?
Yeah.
Easy to see and focus on. And they're there for reference, too. Mm-hmm. So.
As long as you have your glasses and you're
yeah.
okay.
Remember your glasses. If not, I'll make them bigger.
Actually, I went to work today, so basically I had to wear my glasses.
It's good to know what you're doing when you're at work.
Yeah.
All right. If there are no other questions, you may leave. Thank you for coming, and we'll see you next week.